Welcome to the Second Age Podcast. We're the Lorehounds, your guides to Tolkien's world of Middle-earth. I'm David.
I'm John, and this is Chapter 5, The Last Alliance.
In this episode, we've got three segments, a discussion of Tolkien's wartime experience, some discussion of the themes of the weakness of the will of men and the loss of loved ones, and then we're going to deep dive into the war against Sauron.
Before we get started, here's a quick reminder that you can send feedback to secondage@baldmove.com, and we'll get to those questions on the final episode, which will be a Q&A.
If you want to talk Tolkien sooner with us, join us over on the Bald Move Discord. There's a link in the show notes below and on baldmove.com. And be sure to get all the Bald Move and Lorehounds coverage of Rings of Power by subscribing to the Dug Too Deep podcast feed. We're going to be releasing exclusive content on this feed, so you don't want to miss out. Click on the link in the show notes or search for Dug Too Deep in your podcast application of choice. All right, so let's get started with our first segment and let's talk about Tolkien and his experience in World War I. All right, John, why don't you lay it out for us?
Sure. So England declared war on Germany in 1914. Tolkien was conflicted at this point because he wanted to help his country by enlisting, but he also wanted to finish his academic studies because he was right in the middle of his undergrad.
I think that that must have been a tough choice for him, too, because I'm sure, you know, sort of the patriotic expectation of young Englishmen at that point was to enlist, like, right away.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I think that was really tough for him.
Yeah.
But he found a program that would let him sort of do both. And so he was allowed to complete his studies while he completed his training at the same time.
Okay.
And he had begun to attempt fiction and poetry at this point. So this was a big developmental period for him, too.
So is this where he started hanging out with these Tea Club fellows?
Yeah. So we mentioned the Tea Club in his biography chapter. But the Tea Club was sort of this club consisting of himself, Christopher Wiseman, G.B. Smith, and R.Q. Gilson, and about five others, but these four were sort of the core of it.
Okay.
And this was his fellowship.
Right. And they were, like, all into poetry and painting and drawing and, like, super intellectually ambitious type young men, right?
Yeah, I think they considered themselves Renaissance men, and
okay.
It was about male companionship, but it was also about sort of improving yourself intellectually and challenging each other, and I think he really took a ton away from this group.
Right. And what is it? I know that we call it the Tea Club, but its official acronym is TCBS, which stands for Tea Club and Barrovian Society.
Very exotic.
Do we have any sort of, do we have any sort of indication of, like, what that was about?
I don't know what a Barrovian society is, so
okay.
your guess is as good as mine.
They like to drink tea. They like to hang out, right?
I also like tea. I've okay. Never heard of the Barrovians.
Okay. We're going to get a lot of email about that, I'm sure.
You know, I hope we do.
All right, very good, very good.
Educate me.
Right. Hit us up. Okay, so what happens then?
So Tolkien takes his last exam. He goes into service. He ends up in the same general group, but not the same battalion as his friend G.B. Smith. They're in the Lancashire Fusiliers.
Right.
Do you know how to say that?
You said it right. Lancashire Fusiliers.
All right. He did not care for his peers at all. He said to Edith, "Gentlemen are rare among the superiors, and even human beings are rare indeed."
So this is sort of... I guess, I mean, like, he does come from polite English society. He's university educated. So, I mean, England is a class-based society. So, yeah, this is probably the first time where he's really mixed with a lot of folks from class, you know, not his class.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one reading of it. I also a little bit read it as they were being a little rude about things.
Jocular.
Yeah.
Alpha, yeah.
You know, if we people politely call it locker room talk,
right?
Too politely, I think. And I think that he was not a big fan of that. You know, he was very prim and proper about a lot of things.
Right. Much more genteel. And
he's the Catholic.
And we should say that he was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Fusiliers, in the Lancashire Fusiliers. But he took a special job.
Right. He started to specialize in signaling.
Okay.
So he was transmitting messages rather than, you know, directly fighting battle.
Right, okay.
And so he would go from Morse code to carrier pigeons and everything in between.
Signal flags and stuff like that. Well, I mean, it suits his background, right, as a linguist and a communicator.
Yeah, and maybe that's why he had the eagles sending messages eventually.
Yeah, but we can't discount that possibility.
It's true. It's true. So at this point, he marries Edith because he's like, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in war. And, you know, we love each other. We're going to get married.
Right. That's what you do, right? You get married before you go off and die, right?
Of course. Like, you know, just because crazy to me. That's what we should do. We should send young men off to go into brutal battle with no experience. And that's
a good thing. Irony alert. In
society.
Yeah.
So he goes into combat. He's sent to France in 1916, in June 1916. And this is sort of the year where everything starts going down for him.
Right. And this is the Battle of the Somme, which is a major, major engagement during the war.
Right. And he enjoyed some of his new superiors a little better. He based Sam Gamgee off of one of his officers.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he ended up going further into the war zone. It was raining. The ground's muddy. The war feels like inescapable. So he's really feeling this weight of war now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So in July, Rob Gilson, remember that's one of the T Club members.
Okay.
His battalion was killed after being openly fired on. G.B. Smith was there too, but he survived that battle.
Right.
And so Tolkien and Smith were just devastated over this. You know,
right.
We've lost the T Club.
I mean, this isn't just like a couple of buddies that you would meet up with at the bar and shoot the shit with. This is like these guys were like really bonded to each other. Like they were like, you know, pinky swear, blood brother type whole thing.
Yeah, and I think they bonded to each other in sort of the immortality of youth, you know?
Mm.
We'll be together forever. We'll be
right
making this art forever. We're all going to change the world together.
Okay.
So Tolkien is in battle now, and he's surprised by the chaos of the actual battlefield. You know, the wires, he's trained in these perfect environments, but the wires right. in battle are tangled and unmanageable. He's like, what is this?
Right.
He couldn't even use Morse code because it was so dangerous, so he had to use the visual methods of signaling. There's mm-hmm. decaying bodies all around. There's, you know, mm-hmm. trees and nature are destroyed. We know how much the trees mean to Tolkien.
Right.
And he was experiencing these horrors of the war for the first time. He described it as animal horror.
I think when we start talking about the fight against Sauron, and definitely in Lord of the Rings, or Return of the King, I guess, is probably the correct book for this, is where Sam and Frodo are trying to cross these battle plains. And so this is really where that kind of imagery and mood and tone that he's writing about probably comes from. It's probably inspired by these experiences.
I think so. And I think there's also a lot of points in the books, especially in the Two Towers, when Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas are going off to find the hobbits and things like that, which is so sleep deprived and so out of it. And, you know, there's a point in one of Tolkien's battles where he's up 48 hours before he gets to rest in a trench, not even in a bed, but like a trench. And his battalion suffers all these deaths, but he comes out miraculously without injuries.
Right.
You know, I think that this stuff carries out into his work, and you see him understand what it feels like to be exhausted while you're doing this mission.
Right. Yeah.
Funny detail a little bit. There was a captured German soldier in the camp, and he offered the soldier water, and the man corrected his German pronunciation because, you know, Tolkien can't not work on his linguistics while he's
right.
with a while war prisoner.
And isn't this when he starts writing some fragments of what will later enter into the Legendarium?
Yeah, he's working on things like the story of Arendil. Arendil, the story does not really reflect what became later, but he's beginning this work. That will later become the Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion, rather.
And it's kind of, I mean, it has to be inspired by the Tea Club and this camaraderie he has with his fellow members, because they were influencing each other, driving each other, inspiring each other to do this stuff. to do this stuff by meaning art, to create art and be creative.
Yeah, and he was sending these poems back and forth with, you know, G.B. Smith and some of the other Tea Club members. They were giving him constructive feedback, like real constructive feedback, the kind that you actually want and not the friend, oh, that was nice.
It's crazy to think that they're in the middle of this, like, brutal war, and yet they're, like, you know, editing each other and giving each other creative feedback.
I think it's something that we should consider more often, which is that we're sending human beings to war, not bodies.
Yeah.
And these people are such rich humans.
Right.
And yet they're being sent to just kill each other.
Right.
Anyway.
Okay.
This is not a war podcast.
But no. But I think it's important to bring in that sense of humanity, because here Tolkien was, he was a whole human being, and they were these young men who were in the prime, and a whole nations, being funneled into this, you know, grinder of an experience.
I think it says a lot that Tolkien spent most of his life being a pacifist afterward.
Right.
Because this stuff was just horrific, and I think that really, you could see it in his work, you could see it in the way he views the world, and so that's why it's so important that we're talking about this stuff.
And it was the first mechanized war, where you actually had machines of war at scale doing this stuff. And I think I remember in the Jackson films and reading the books with Saruman and the way that, you know, they created industry to create a war machine, literally a machine, which, like, the Ents were, like, aghast by, right? Because all of their forests are being ripped up and nature is being destroyed. And so this goes into some of the point-counterpoint stuff that Tolkien does and embedded deeper in his work, where he's, you know, giving you one thematic element and then bringing up the counterpoint to it and contrasting them.
I should add, too, to that his friend, the first friend that died, was killed in a machine gun raid where people were just being gunned down in mass numbers for the first time in war.
Right. Yeah.
So I think you're right.
Yeah. And the Battle of the Somme in that area, that's like when we think of World War One, that's where it was happening. Like, that's where we think of trench warfare. That's what was happening in that battle at that scale. Yeah.
Now it's horrible.
Yeah.
Speaking of trenches, Tolkien gets trench fever in October 1916. And he's sent away to receive treatment in France. He's not recovering in France, so he's sent back to England. And that's the last time he's ever sent back to the front. He never sees war again.
So trench fever is actually a bacteria that's carried by body lice. And at the time, I did a little reading on this, they didn't know what was causing it, why all these men were falling ill. And I guess I read one statistic where up to a fifth of both the both armies were completely out of commission because of trench fever.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And at the time, they didn't have any known cure for it. You just had to recover on your own. And I think the mortality was very low. But like with somebody like with Tolkien, it took a very long time for him to recover on his own. And now I think they can just use some antibiotics to treat it. But back then, you just had to, you know, it was just your constitution. Could your body, you know, fight the infection? And it took Tolkien just a long time to do that.
Yeah, it took him a couple months, and he did recover fully, which is great.
Yes.
Otherwise, we would not be having this podcast.
It's true.
And in December, he's recovered, but he receives a letter from Christopher Wiseman, another one of the Tea Club, informing him that G.B. Smith had died. Mm-hmm. That's the man he was in the same major group as.
Right.
And just before G.B. Smith had left to go on his final mission, he wrote Tolkien one last letter.
Which I think you've copied out for us here, which I'll read a little bit of a quote from. It's a little bit, it's not long, but it's not just short.
It's powerful, though.
My chief consolation is that if I am scuppered tonight, I am off duty in a few minutes. There will still be left a member of the great TCBS to voice what I dreamed and what we all agreed upon. For the death of one of its members cannot, I am determined, dissolve the TCBS. Death can make us loathsome and helpless as individuals, but it cannot put an end to the immortal four. May God bless you, my dear John Ronald, and may you say the things I have tried to say long after I am not there to say them, if such may be my lot. Yours ever, GBS.
Wow.
Well, I got a little chills there reading that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can overstate how impactful this was for Tolkien and how this loss really affected him, not just of him, but the other member of the TCBS. And I think that, you know, when you're watching Boromir say goodbye to, to Aragorn.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, my captain, my king. It's the same feeling. It's that, please go finish what I couldn't.
Right. And they really were driving forces on each other, of inspiration and creativity.
Yeah.
I think too, something that I've seen, you know, as we're, you know, doing the research for this and, you know, Googling around and stuff, you see a lot of people like, oh, well, is Lord of the Rings about war and about wartime experience? And I, to me, as much as the war, as Tolkien's war experience has an impact and an influence on the story, Lord, it's not just all about war, though, either.
Right.
I think as we talked about in the prologue episode about Tolkien the man, he was a whole and complete person, and so he's bringing all of his experiences into his writing and into his creativity.
Yeah.
And I no doubt that a lot of Lord of the Rings is probably him working out a lot of his thoughts and feelings and emotions about his wartime experience. And I just really appreciate the way that he integrates it so that it's not like, oh, this is just me working out my wartime issues. But this mythology that he's created is just so great and whole and encompassing of all of these different human experiences.
Right. And there's that essence of truth there, right? You know how he's trying to pull truth out of this mythology.
Yeah.
Who is the hero of The Lord of the Rings? And how does Sauron really get defeated in the Lord of the Rings is through acts of mercy, through the mercy that Frodo shows to Gollum, through the kindness that Sam shows to Frodo. And I think that Tolkien, after this, sees fellowship, sees this kindness as the key to saving the world, not war.
And when you look at the relationship between Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli, right? You know, three people from vastly different experiences and backgrounds who are, you know, joining together in common purpose.
Right. And we even have that in this episode today with the joining of men and elves and some dwarves.
Right. Exactly. All right. So should we talk a little bit about some of the background themes? We've got the weakness of the will of men, kind of point counterpoint here, and then the loss of, what do we say?
Loss of loved ones.
Loss of loved ones, yeah, which is very poignant in this.
You know, I think that we've talked a lot about the loss of loved ones already, but...
Yeah, agreed.
I think it's just... He really felt that loss. I mean, you know, in his childhood, he loses his mother.
Right.
He loses some of his best friends in the war. He later finds fellowship in the Inklings. He loses C.S. Lewis eventually. C.S. Lewis is only in his mid-60s, I believe.
Right.
So Tolkien is no stranger to loss. And I think that that's reflected in The Lord of the Rings and even today when we talk about the last alliance of men and elves and the loss of some of the characters there. I think that some of the characters' motivations can be explained by their trauma.
Mm.
And he's taking that from his own life.
Yeah, exactly.
But we also have the weakness of the will of men, and that's a little bit of the flip side.
Yeah, and we see we're living in a world of that's currently being affected by that, aren't we?
I think so. I think we're always living in that. And
yeah, it's true.
you see... Through this story, you see constantly men failing to overcome their desire for power, failing to overcome the desire to dominate, and sort of not being able to do the right thing in the face of a tough decision.
Right.
But you also see them sometimes overcoming that. So keep an eye out for that weakness of the will of men. You know, we talked about last time the dwarves were not so easily dominated. The men are very easily dominated by the rings. Keep an eye on that as we go through this story.
Sounds good. All right, well, let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, let's talk about the Last Alliance and the war against Sauron.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, and we're back. So, John, the last alliance of elves and men?
Men and elves and men. The whole deal.
Yeah, this is it. Like, and we should probably hang, I know we maybe have said this a little bit earlier, we should hang this warning again. This is some spoilery territory that potentially we could be seeing in season 4, season 5 of this show.
Yeah, this looks to be the end game kind of thing. Although the battle that we're seeing, the end of it shows up in that intro of The Lord of the Rings with Isildur. So it's stuff that people generally know the rough edges of, but we're going to be going into deep detail here.
Right, and they still have a lot of latitude in terms of how they're going to tell this story mm-hmm. and what characters they're going to put into conflict and how certain things are going to resolve. So while there's some spoilery warnings in general, yeah, we've already – if you've seen the Peter Jackson movies, then you've seen some of this action already.
Right.
All right, so Sauron has a ring.
Sauron does have a ring, as we know.
Yes.
From previous episodes. Sauron's got his ring, and the elves, we talked about last time, how Sauron had sort of infiltrated the elves, but we've got to catch them up a little bit, because we didn't get to quite the end of how Sauron has interacted with them.
Okay.
So Sauron had put on that ring, we talked about, and that alerts the elves, that alerts the ring bearers that, hey, this guy Annatar, he's up to no good, he's not really Annatar, he's Sauron. Mm-hmm. So they sense that, and they immediately remove the rings. But Sauron also senses them, and he's like, oh, man, they know me now. My whole plan, it's all over. So I'm going to go destroy Eregion. So that city Eregion, that Celebrimbor ran, gets attacked by Sauron.
Okay.
And Celebrimbor is killed in that process.
Uh-oh. Celebrimbor was the grandson of the witch
dude? Of Feanor.
Right.
The creator of the Silmarils, right. And so Celebrimbor is the guy who made the Elven Rings.
Got it. Yeah, right. Yeah, and he was into smithing, and then Sauron in his guise as a smithy dude taught him a lot of fancy tricks about ring making.
Exactly.
Right.
And so Elrond was there trying to help out Eregion get Sauron back, but they weren't successful. But he says, you know what, I'm one of the leaders of the Noldor now. I need to help get these people to safety. So he creates the Last Homely House, which is a term you'll have heard if you've read The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings or watched the movies. The Last Homely House is Rivendell, sometimes called Imladris in Elvish.
Right.
And it is that city that you see quite mm-hmm. all over the place.
Right. A pretty nice place.
Yeah, so we'll probably see the founding of Rivendell on the show at some point.
That would be cool. That would be very cool.
Yeah, and so now we have three home bases for elves, at least these western elves, the Noldor, the Sindar, right. The Sylvan elves. And that is Lindon, the Grey Havens. That's where okay. they're sailing off, and that's where Gil-galad right. is. Then we have Rivendell, run by Elrond.
Right.
And we have Lothlorien, where Galadriel is probably at this point, but she's not really okay. running it yet, unless they change that for the show.
Interesting. This will be a little bit dated if you're listening to this podcast in the future, but there was just a bunch of production stills released, and we've seen Galadriel in her warrior princess phase and some of the stuff that they've just released. So I'm kind of excited to see what they do with that and with Lothlorien.
Yeah, me too. I'm a fan of the warrior Galadriel interpretation that they're doing.
100%.
Yeah. I know that there's been some debate about it, but I'm a fan of it.
Yeah. Well, okay. So let's see what we get here. And I guess on that note, it's like the elves decide to fight Sauron now. They know what's up, and they figure they probably got to do something about it.
Yeah, so Sauron's attacking them and antagonizing them, and they're saying, all right, we got to do something about this because this is not sustainable.
Right.
But we have another faction, another big group, and that's the men. We haven't talked about them since Chapter 2, The Fall of Numenor.
Right. So where do these things line up? So with like the death of Celebrimbor and then the men and Numenor, how do these things kind of line up? What's a couple of points that we can connect these two groups to?
So Sauron had created the rings and had this whole attack on Eregion before he even went to Numenor.
Oh, wow. So this happened way before.
Right.
Oh,
so we backed up a little bit. But okay. Now we're going to catch the men back up.
Okay.
Because Sauron went to Numenor. We talked about that whole thing. They fell. Sauron was caught in the drowning, but he survived. He just can't change back into a fair form after that. So he had tricked the elves before this in his fair form. Now he's stuck in this like great, terrible lord form, his trademark, I'm the big bad guy look.
Yes, the one that we know, that we've seen visually.
Right. Classic Sauron.
Yes.
And so we have to catch the men up after they left Numenor, because remember, we had this group of the faithful who escaped at the last minute the fall of Numenor.
Right, yep.
So the faithful, remember, are Elendil, which was the son of Amandil, and his son Isildur, and his other son Anarion.
Okay.
So these are the three leaders of the Numenoreans who escaped. They created two new kingdoms when they came to Middle-earth, and they're called Gondor and Arnor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we know Gondor, right?
We know Gondor. That's, you know, Minas Tirith we get to, run by Denethor and his son Boromir and his son Faramir at the time of the Lord of the Rings. Arnor, though, is in the north, and at the time of the Lord of the Rings, it doesn't really exist anymore. It's kind of fallen.
So that watchtower, would that have been part of Arnor? Is that the kind of lands where we find, what's his name, the ranger running around?
Aragorn?
Aragorn, yes. I can't believe it. That's forgot his name.
That's okay.
Where Strider is running around. Is that like, was that Arnor, that kind of area?
Yeah, so it was north of Gondor, and there were a lot of Numenorean ruins over there because they had built up all these fortresses both before and after the fall of Numenor.
Interesting. Okay.
Right. So Isildur and Anarion ruled together in Osgiliath, which is, if you remember in The Lord of the Rings, if you've seen the extended editions, Boromir sort of retakes this ruined city, and that is Osgiliath.
Yeah, that was a great battle scene. Yeah. Yeah, that was a very cool scene there. Okay, so that's Osgiliath. That's sort of like a city nearby Minas Tirith.
Right. It's pretty nearby. It used to be the main capital of basically the two kingdoms. At the time of the Lord of the Rings, it was not really controlled by Gondor anymore.
Right. It's kind of a no man's land.
Right. They create other strongholds, too.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Minas Ithil, which is Isildur's city. It's the Tower of the Rising Moon.
I don't think I've heard of that one at all. Where do you have an idea of where that is?
Yeah, well, at the time of the Lord of the Rings, it's called Minas Morgul because Sauron has taken it over.
Oh!
Yeah, so that's like in Sauron's territory now.
Got it, okay.
And we also have Minas Anor, which is belonging to Anarion.
Okay.
And that is the Tower of the Setting Sun.
I don't know that one either.
Minas Anor is eventually renamed Minas Tirith. And so we do know that one, just by a different name.
Okay, interesting. Very cool.
And then the last one you might recognize is Orthanc in Isengard. Mm-hmm. That was an unbreakable stone fortress that Saruman hides out in at the time of his demise in The Lord of the Rings. Okay, so the Numenoreans had brought with them the Seven Palantiri, the Seeing Stones.
Oh, those are the stones that Saruman had.
Right, exactly. And also Denethor had one. There were seven of them originally. Most of them are lost at the time of The Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
And as we know, they can sort of communicate with each other, but a person of virtue and skill could use them to see things far off, whether in place or time. So they were actually much more powerful in their day when people knew how to use them.
Wow, okay. And maybe you had to be of Numenorean strength or skill, sort of virtue.
I think the elves could have used them too, like that. I mean, they were the ones who created them as well. But in general, people have forgotten how to use these the right way by the time of the Lord of the Rings.
Right. And then there's only two left at that time. So, okay.
Right. And they also brought with them the White Tree. Remember, Isildur had saved that tree from the king's court. So he plants that in Minas Ithil.
Okay.
And the men, because they're so far-seeing, begin to perceive that Sauron is back in Barad-dûr, that he's survived the fall of Numenor, he's back and better than ever in his terrible lord form, and he is going to cause them trouble. So we've basically caught up at this point from where we were with the men last time we saw them.
Okay, so there's actually kind of a lot going on here.
Yeah, people have been busy. So they've founded two kingdoms. Yeah. That's the main thing you need to know, is they founded these two kingdoms, they've settled in, and they're starting to get a little ticked off about Sauron, too.
Okay. All right. So then Sauron, meanwhile, is busy.
Sauron is busy, and he's creating a huge army of men from the south and the east. Also, some Numenoreans who were there before the fall of Numenor, right, who had already set up fortresses in Middle-earth before the fall.
Right.
And also his standard orc followers, etc. And then there are two great Haradrim men, which are sort of these like southern men, and they're captains in Sauron's armies, Herimor and Fëanor. I don't know if I'm saying that latter one right, but somebody will probably write in and tell me.
Probably. Do we know if we're going to see these guys in the show, or is it still too early for us to know?
Well, they haven't been cast yet, but we're talking Endgame stuff, so they could cast that season 4 and probably be fine.
Right. Okay.
So Sauron is getting busy, so he's going to start attacking. He had already attacked the elves, remember, but now he's going to attack the men, and he attacks the city of Minas Ithil, and he again destroys the White Tree.
Dope!
Isildur, the sly guy he is, comes in, swoops in, and gets a seedling and saves it.
Okay. Well, he's got faith.
He's got his faith.
Faithful. Yep.
Sauron attacks Osgiliath, but is driven back into Mordor by Anarion.
Okay.
And Gil-galad and Elendil had become besties at this point. They're very close. Elendil had been a friend to elves when he was in Numenor, and that's the same thing now that he's in Middle-earth.
Right.
So they have a little chat, and they say, you know, Sauron's really becoming a huge problem. We're going to have to do something about this. And they get together, and they create the greatest army seen since the Valar took down Morgoth in the First Age.
Big army.
Big army of mostly men and elves. But also, we know that at this point, Middle-earth is becoming divided between Sauron and the forces of good, or the forces of the free peoples of Middle-earth. And so the elves are all on the good side, right? Because they just absolutely hate Sauron, and elves are supposed to be men before the fall in Tolkien's vision, so they're all going to do the right thing.
Right.
Men are going to mostly go to Sauron, you know, the south and the eastern men. But this western men, the Numenoreans and those who live under them, they're going to go with Gil-galad and Elendil.
Right. And where are the dwarves in all of this?
The dwarves mostly sit out. But
The
dwarves that were next to Eregion, Khazad-dûm, remember that's the great kingdom that becomes Moria, that becomes ruins by the time of the Lord of the Rings, they're going to be led by Durin, and they're going to fight alongside the men and the elves.
Okay. So we get some dwarves on the side of men and elves, but some dwarves side with Sauron.
Some dwarves do. We don't really have a lot of writing about that, but, you know, they could put that into the show if they want.
Okay, interesting. All right, so we got some latitude there in production. Mm-hmm. All right, so we've got this massive army heading down to take on Sauron before the Black Gates, I'm guessing?
Right, so they march to the Black Gate. Dagorlad is what the Great Battle Plain is called. And they go from Rivendell to Dagorlad, the battle plain, to have this battle. So Gil-galad is wielding his spear Eglos, and Elendil is wielding his sword Narsil, and they lead their armies to victory against the orc host and against the men who were there, and they just keep beating back Sauron's armies and winning.
Okay, and isn't Narsil the sword that Aragorn picks up in Rivendell, the one that's broken?
Absolutely it is, and Elrond has had it for quite a while, but Aragorn's going to get that back eventually, but yep, this is the one.
Right, yeah. Okay, got it.
So the last alliance surrounds Barad-dûr. Remember, that's Sauron's big tower in Mordor.
Right.
And they besiege Sauron for 7 years. God, I hope they don't do that in the TV show.
Probably not. And then this is kind of where, you know, we can definitely see Tolkien's wartime experience infused into the storyline.
I would say so, yeah. I mean, as we talked about, Tolkien saw the horror of war,
right,
and he knew that a siege was not going to be bloodless. And Sauron is sending out ranged weapons, basically. He's using fire, darts, and bolts to kill as many of the men and elves as he can.
Right. So very much sort of this artillery and this ruined plane and, mass casualties.
Right. And then we have this loss, as we talked about loss in the theme section, of Anarion. Anarion is killed in the Valley of Gorgoroth during the siege, and Isildur loses his brother.
That sounds very ominous. The Valley of Gorgoroth, right? That does not sound like a place that I want to die.
Sauron has finally come out to play, and Anarion is dead, so he attacks Elendil and Gil-galad, and they're fighting their butts off. They get killed in the process, but they strike a killing blow on him, and he falls. Elendil then falls on his sword and shatters it.
Okay, which is Narsil, right?
That's Narsil.
And we know that, where that shows up later. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And Isildur takes the hilt of Narsil and cuts off Sauron's finger with the ring on it, takes it for its own.
Right.
So Sauron's spirit leaves his body.
Right.
Sauron goes into hiding, and the Second Age comes to an end.
Well, okay. And that's our point, that's our sort of our aim point for this 5-season series of Rings of Power, is they're trying to match up to that target of this end of the Second Age.
Yeah, I could see them going as far as sort of the last things that we see of Isildur in The Lord of the Rings, which is, you know, when he struck down. But I can't imagine them going farther than that.
Right. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they play it and how far they take it. So, okay. Great. Well, that is a lot. And we're almost to the end of our journey.
We are.
We've got one chapter left, The Aftermath, chapter 6.
Yeah, we've just got to catch up. We're going to do some linking up with the Third Age, and we're going to sort of connect all this stuff to The Lord of the Rings and see how this journey takes us, see where this journey takes us.
And then I think we're also going to talk a little bit about Tolkien and his relationship with his son, Christopher, who really, without Christopher, we would not even be able to be talking in depth like we are now.
Yeah, Christopher is responsible for it all, really.
Yeah, pretty awesome. Okay, great. Well, we'll see you on the next chapter then. The Second Age podcast is produced by the Lorehounds and published by Bald Move.
You can send questions and feedback about this podcast to secondage@baldmove.com. For more Rings of Power content, subscribe to Dug Too Deep on your favorite podcast app.
Ad-free versions of this and all other Bald Move podcasts can be yours by going to patreon.com/baldmove. Check the show notes for reading recommendations and more info. Thanks for listening.